Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with actor Richard B. Watson. I was lucky enough to see Richard in a production of The Birds at the American Stage Theater in St. Petersburg, Florida, which you will not be able to see because the run is over. But I really wanted to interview Richard because he was amazing in The Birds, and because I discovered that he had been in the one and only production of Treasure Island, a new musical. And I have interviewed previously Corinne Agalina, one of the creative team of Treasure Island, a new musical, an interview I will play sometime in the future, and I wanted to hear about that production. In addition, it turns out that Richard is about to appear in a production of Nicholas Nickleby in Orlando in January. So, if you are intrigued by this interview, which I cannot imagine you will not be, because he has so much to say about what it means to be an actor, and if you find yourself near Orlando, Florida in January, I'm sure you will want to run out and see Nicholas Nickleby. In any case, there are wonderful stories in this interview. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from
simply about being who you really are. And if you've been listening, you've heard me say over and over again that as a psychotherapist, I am aware that many of us are acting out of a cover story, a version of who we are, which is not the whole truth. And that so much of who we are can have been buried undercover, hidden so well that we forget we have it. And it is the intent of The Lynn Show to point this out, to say, maybe there's a quality, a way of being, a behavior, an attitude, something about yourself which didn't go over well in your family of origin or with a particular teacher or with your culture or someplace. And so you decided that it was better not to demonstrate this particular part of yourself, and you figured out a way to hide it so well that even you have forgotten that it is there. And again, as a therapist, I believe that our lives are better lived if we have access to all of who we are. And so again, the intent of the show is to point out that there may in fact be something about you which you would be better off recovering. If you want to know more about this and or more about me or more about psychotherapy on the telephone, you can get that information by going to my website, thelynshow.com. T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E. Don't leave the E out of Lynn, thelynshow.com. I usually talk much more about that at the beginning of the shows, but today I want to play all of this interview, and it's pretty long, so I'm not going to talk much longer. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, and I do it because when you listen to them, you know what it sounds like. You hear it, what it sounds like to be congruent, to be who you really are. And today's interview is a perfect demonstration of what it sounds like to be an actor. Listen to Richard B. Watson tell the story of beginning in kindergarten to come home and perform all of that day's Sesame Street. This was clearly a boy who knew who he was and what he was from the very beginning, and he's never let go of it. And so all of the stories that you listen to that Richard B. Watson tells demonstrate his passionate commitment and his willingness to take leaps in the name of his work. So again, I don't want to take up any more time, and so now here is Richard B. Watson.
Okay, I'm here with Richard B. Watson in my kitchen, and Richard is in Florida because he is with the ensemble company of the Birds, which
is American Stage Theater Company, up in St. Petersburg, Florida. Of a production of The Birds by Connor McPherson, adapted from Daphne du Maurier's novelette.
And otherwise seen in Alfred Hitchcock's infamous
movie. There's a version out there, I hear, that Alfred Hitchcock did.
Really? My God. And if you were listening a couple of weeks ago, you heard my interview with Roxanne Fay, who co-stars with Richard, and I'm sorry you're not going to be able to see it, because by the time I air this, it will have closed. Yeah. Too bad for you.
Yep.
So I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Okay.
And it's quite clear that you make some of your life,
all
of your life and your living as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
So I only ask one question, really, and that is, can you remember, pinpoint, tell me, the very first moment in your life when you thought, oh, it's nice to have people look at me, I like telling stories, it's nice when people laugh when I say things, I stand on the kitchen table, no?
Well, I think the earliest memory that I have of even going down that road, I had to have been 2 or 3, when we went to, when I went to kindergarten in Wilmington, North Carolina, we would watch Sesame Street, and I would come home, and God bless my parents, they were so patient, and I would basically do that day's performance of Sesame Street for my parents.
That's great.
And it would become, you know, as the years progressed, you know, as until I turned 5, and thankfully I had to be shipped off to school during the day, and we stopped doing that. They would become more and more elaborate with puppets, and I would, you know, start adding lighting effects and costumes.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so, you know, they put up with it every single, 5 days a week, anytime that
oh
I went
God.
Into, counting down the numbers and all of the different voices of all of the different characters and all of the live people that were in the show and all of the songs that they sang that day. So it was pretty immersive as far as
it's amazing the theatrical
experience is concerned.
I mean, it's amazing in a lot of ways that you remembered it.
Yeah.
You know, that you wanted to share it, that you wanted to do it, right? That you obviously enjoyed the hell out of it.
Oh, I loved it.
Right. And that they embraced it.
They did.
That they honored it.
I couldn't. I look back on it now, especially my father. I just think, wow, he was really, really patient.
Why do you say that?
You know, he's by heart, he's a carpenter, a mechanic, an electrician, a plumber. You know, he lays concrete. And
yeah.
So it's this was. I'm sure he was seeing his only son going, okay, he's going to be an actor. All right. Okay. All right. I got it.
And God bless him.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. He was very supportive.
This comes up.
And Mom especially, too. I mean, she's always been supportive, so.
This comes up in my interviews all the time. Either we get this, mm-hmm. which is to be desired,
right.
or we get the other, which is they didn't like it. Right. Yeah. Right. And the price that people pay for having to do that, even though they're not getting
the support,
which is...
Lots of support. Tons of support for us. All my life, especially for my mom. I think my father, he put up with it, and his mantra is, whatever makes you happy. I'm completely 100% behind you. My mother, of course, you know, from day one, just absolutely loved it. So she just was, keep doing it. It's so much fun. I enjoy watching you perform, and if that's what you want to do, that's what it. They divorced when I was 9, and she remarried about a year and a half, 2 years later, to a wonderful man, my stepfather, who has been, you know, just as supportive throughout the whole thing. He has 2 sons, so that are not, as a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, I think I'm the only person in my family, even extended, on both sides, that's an actor. On my father's side of the family, there are a few of them that are involved in music in Wilmington, North Carolina. Have their own band. It's not what they do for a living, but they make an avocation of it, a pretty strenuous avocation.
But that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
That's not coming from anywhere. So
I don't know where it came from.
Well, it came from Sesame Street.
It came from Sesame Street,
right.
That's it.
So we owe Sesame Street for, you know. I want to tell you that at the intermission, I was standing next to the board, the board of directors guy. He said, you are his favorite actor.
Oh, that's so nice.
Uh-huh. I thought you might. I mean, and I'm in a position to be able to tell you that, even if he didn't. Right.
I've been at American Stage for 2 other shows. The first time that I performed there was about 3 years ago. It was George in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Mm. Oh, he talked about that, actually.
And that was a, just all the way up and down, that entire experience is top 5 experience in my life.
Wow.
Todd cast me a year prior because there are all sorts of specifics that Ed Albee stipulates for that particular show.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. He's very particular.
Do you remember what they are?
Well, number one, he has, Mr. Albee has final say in the casting.
For every production?
Every production of Who's Afraid of Virginia.
You're kidding. My God, it must be being done everywhere sometime.
Mm.
Apparently not.
No.
Maybe because of this.
Well, that's a part of it. He requires, I think there were productions that were done before in the 80s.
He didn't like it.
Well, he would show up. He will show up to these things. Everywhere, all over the world. He'll just fly there and go. And I think he showed up to one, and the Martha was not the right age.
Ah.
And he, you know, basically just went to the producers and said, this isn't right. This is not what I wrote.
Wow.
In order for me to not pull the rights, you're going to have to allow me to put a notice in your playbill saying that I disagree with the casting.
Oh, you're kidding.
And he did, and they did. And so, you know, from that time forward, he stipulated, you have to send me their picture, their headshot and resume, and I have final say on who gets cast, especially the Martha and the George.
Weren't you young for it?
I was the correct age.
You just don't look it.
I just looked young.
Right.
And that was a concern of the artistic director,
yeah.
Todd. He said, you know, what do you look like when you let your beard grow out? What do you...
Can we put the gray back in?
And basically, I told him, look, I color everything.
Yeah, right.
My agent, you know, when I show up in New York City, right. If I walk in the door and she takes one look at me and she says, gray doesn't pay, and she will say nothing more to me until I turn around, walk out of the room, and come back in and either have my beard shaved or my hair colored. So... I said, I've got plenty of gray and plenty of white. Mm-hmm. All we have to do is just let it grow out a bit, and it'll be there. And they let me grow a beard for George in the show, and my beard is very white.
Oh yeah,
it's very very white, and my hair has got a lot of salt and pepper gray in it. Mm-hmm. And so after, and it was a year prior, so
so you looked the part, right?
Fun.
Wow.
And also another stipulation that Ed Albee has is that he requires every theater company that's going to perform the show to give exactly 4 weeks of rehearsal, which is usually unheard of. I mean, typically you'll get 2, possibly 3 weeks of rehearsal for any given production when you do a regional theater somewhere, unless it's a new piece or it's a musical or it's a very intricate show. Ed Albee requires 4 weeks of rehearsal, and that's another reason why the show isn't performed all over the places.
Yeah,
because
okay.
it's
because
expensive.
Most places can't do
it's expensive.
It. Right.
But he requires, you know, he's like, look,
this is my play.
Is
you want the rights?
It's a three-act play that has a lot of nooks and crannies in it, and for you to, you know, not use the first week of performance as your final week of rehearsal, I want you to open the show with it having a soul that's in place, and the only way you're going to do that is you have to rehearse it for 4 weeks.
Well, you know, I mean, he can do that.
Yeah,
he can do that.
Sure can.
Yeah, right.
And it's just a marvelous piece.
Yeah, I know. Okay, so we have you at kindergarten,
mm-hmm.
and then you start school.
Okay.
And so, how does your career progress from there?
I was always involved, one way, shape, or form, or another, in elementary school, and
did you have plays in elementary school?
Yeah,
you did?
Yeah, occasionally. It was always, anytime there was anything that had a performance, whether it be you know, chorus or they were doing a musical and they needed people who were interested in performing in front of people.
They always need boys.
Right in front. I was front and center, the first one to show up, and would always be involved in them. And
so you started to sing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I was singing with the Sesame Street.
Oh, God, that's right. You were singing with
the... Half of Sesame Street is all singing the song.
Yeah,
so,
right.
And I, you know, I saw movies. I was constant. My mother was always taking me to see any movie that I wanted to go see. I remember specifically there was a movie, Escape to Witch Mountain. It was a Disney live action, and it had, who's the guy that was Father Knows Best, but... Sebastian Cabot and Brian Keith. Brian Keith in it. And it had two kids,
mm-hmm.
two twin kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember watching that show, and I was about the same age as those kids, and I kept looking at those kids on the screen, and I was like, how? Why are they on the screen and I'm not? I could never figure that out. I kept going, wait a minute, how is it that somebody that is my age is up there? How did they do that?
Mm-hmm.
And it just baffled me, and to this day, I'm still baffled as to how people do it. It's, how do you get cast in these things? I can never get cast in them. I remember thinking then, if they can do it, I know I can do it.
Yeah.
And so through all of, you know, through all of school.
Elementary school, junior high school.
I was even, at one point in junior high, the University of North Carolina at Wilmington was, I don't know how they must have seen a production that I did in junior high or what have you, but the artistic director there called me up at the school and wanted me to come and audition for shows because they needed juveniles in some of their productions at university. And next thing you know, I started doing university shows there while I was in junior high and high
You're
school.
You're kidding.
And I remember there was a production of Scapino that we did. Doug Swink was the director, and a guy named Tony Rivenbark played Scapino. And it was just this wonderful thing where suddenly this whole world opened up to me. It was like, oh, you can do that? You can get away with that? Because they were, you know, these were professional seasoned actors. They were professional actors, and they were doing all sorts of bold, audacious choices that I would never in a million years would think you could get away with on stage. And Tony Rivenbark, he just had the confidence of being, I didn't know this, of course, as a kid, but he was like the local star. You know, he was always playing the lead roles in these big shows. And
these were college students?
They were college students that had professionals that would come in from the community. I mean, they were college students that were on a BA track or what have you. And then they would supplement the shows that they did with juveniles from high school and junior high and professionals in the theater community that would come in and play like the lead roles or supporting roles and that kind of thing. A lot of universities do that. They kind of tie in. You know, well, they'll do a show that will predominantly be their students, and then they'll piecemeal in the remainder roles. And that's how I got in and did some shows there. And
well, this was, in its way, teaching, a learning experience for you, right? I mean, this was like a drama class.
Absolutely. It was like a little master class.
Exactly. That's what I'm thinking.
And this, the more I look back on it, the more I keep thinking, there was no reason to go to undergrad. There was no reason to go, well, there was good reason to go to grad school, but there was no reason to go to undergrad for acting because it was like doing it is your education. Just doing it. And
doing it in that context, I mean,
especially in a college context.
Exactly, exactly. And where there were professionals, mm-hmm. I mean, you got to learn it just by being in it.
Watching.
Right, by watching.
And going, and being coaxed by, you know, by the likes of Tony in that production of Scapino to leap with him, you know? And going, okay, all right, I have no shame. I have absolutely no problem doing. And as a result, there was just a confidence of just being able to leap without looking. And
you mean literally leap?
Yeah. You know, just to you know, not be afraid of doing and saying anything
right.
in front of that audience
right.
at any given time. And you know, this is a guy that, especially Scapino, it's I can't remember. Maybe it was Goldoni. I'm not sure who wrote the basic idea of the show, but it's an old Italian Lazzi. It's an old Italian style of performance where you tell the story of blah, 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 of
right.
Scapino. You tell the story of Pinocchio.
You tell,
everybody knows that story. You know, when you go to the theater and they're going to tell the story of Pinocchio, you know how it ends. You
right.
know what happens.
Right.
But what's fun is that the actors go off script.
Ah!
What's fun is that when things happen and break down or fall apart or somebody burps in the audience or, you know, a piece of scenery falls down, the whole show can completely go off track. That's the fun.
Wow.
You show up and you never get the same show twice. And with Tony, he was really into that. He was, and not only that, but he would just show up every night with a new energy that would, you know, his reactions to things would be completely off what he did the night before, and so you never knew. And as a result, you started playing with him on a nightly basis. And some nights you would be bold and come in with your own thing, and he'd look at you on stage with, "Oh, okay, you want to play that way, Miss Buster? All right. Well, in that case, I'm going to give you this."
Oh, it's wonderful. Oh, it's like improv.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the most wonderful way to learn.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
Oh God. And
that's what I did at Disney World whenever after undergrad.
Well, wait. So you're still in high school here, right? Or junior high school even, right? Okay, so then you make your way through high school. I'm assuming you
theater
do whatever
department.
Play there. Oh, yeah?
Theater's there, and John T. Hoggard High School in Wilmington, North Carolina, and was also involved in the forensics team with dramatic and humorous interpretation and poetry, and was kind of basically, it was a competition, you know. They would go and they would adjudicate how you did, and you'd move up to the next level, and what else? And it was those two things, theater and the forensics league. And then off to undergrad, University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Never go to your hometown university, just don't. And got my Bachelor of Fine Arts there.
More theater, just doing
theater,
whatever,
theater,
right?
Theater, immersive, everything, you know, learning the rudiments and knowing oh, that's what that's called, and and getting rid of my Southern accent, which was intense.
Really?
Oh, it was awful. It was just all pen and water and door.
Really?
Yeah, oh, it was awful.
Oh, that must have been work then.
Oh, and I had no idea. I remember several of my teachers, they I talked to them now years later, and they said, you came in and you had such a profoundly deep, rural, eastern North Carolina Southern accent that it just tickled us all to death to hear. And the fact that you had no idea that you had it was, made us laugh even more.
Well, they did a good job with you.
Yeah, good, good. I think they did too. It was Sandy Foreman and she teaches at Brown now. Lowry Marshall and Karma Ibsen Riley and John Arnold, who I think he's in the Oslo productions quite a bit here, down here in Sarasota. John Arnold, he was in 12 Angry Men.
Did you see it?
No, I didn't. Mm-hmm. I keep in touch with him. But anyway, that was 4 years, 5 years there, graduated in 89. While I was there, I got accepted to a program to study Shakespeare in London and did that for a year. And that was marvelous, and studied with all of the teachers that were teaching at RADA, and lived there downtown on Gower Street, right across the street from Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts, and it was just wonderful. It was a wonderful year. And finished my Bachelor of Fine Arts degree at University of North Carolina, Greensboro, and and while I was there in the summer times, I also got cast in summer internships. The first one was at the Georgia Shakespeare Festival in Atlanta, and gosh, there was some other ones I can't remember. But when I graduated, I ended up working at the Sterling Renaissance Festival in upstate New York, which was all improv. It's all in complete long form immersive improv, which was, again, as you said before, I think aside from just being on the stage with professionals, one of the best ways to learn how to perform is to perform improv.
I agree.
Because you are able to function in everything that you're involved in, whether you're a waiter in a restaurant, or you're talking to a bunch of CEOs, or you're having a conversation with your friends at a bar. It's just it frees you up to be able to interact in any way, shape, or form that you need to, and with ease and confidence, and not even have to think about it.
That's right.
And it did that for 5.5 years. 5 shows a day, 5 days a week.
Oh, my
five
God.
Years.
Wow.
Yeah, it was fun. And again, it was this kind of Italian idea. We performed at Epcot Center in the Italy Pavilion to begin with. And it was, the idea was, is that we're going to perform a show. The three of us are going to come in. We're going to perform a show for everybody. It's a story everybody knows. The story of whatever. It's loose. It's very loose, you know. You know the story of the three pigs. And I can tell you that story of the three pigs. And I can tell it to you very didactically.
Right.
But I can also go off.
Yes. Right.
And I can involve you.
I was just going to say, and you involve the audience as well.
I can actually put you in the show in places. I can say, I need some help here because I need somebody to stand in for, for the wolf.
Farmer.
For
right.
The farmer.
Right.
Or whatever.
Right.
And that's what we did for 5.5 years. And wow. We did 3 shows there. We created 3 shows in the UK Pavilion. We created a couple of shows in the Canada Pavilion, a couple of shows in the France Pavilion. I developed a show in the China Pavilion. I mean,
what stories did you use in that China
Pavilion? Sun Wukong.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's one of their kind of its deity hero figures.
Huh.
Yeah, the
yeah, right.
It was really a lot of fun. And then moved to New York City.
You said, okay, ready to take on the big city? And was that what it was?
I'd saved a lot of money.
Good boy.
Disney's great with the pay. Mm-hmm. Really superb, especially when you're coming right out of undergrad. You're able to pay off
well,
the school loans.
Yeah, really. It seems to me that you really landed in, I mean...
That's where I got my equity card.
Yes, of course.
At Disney World. As a matter of fact, equity was not established at Disney in 89, but they were trying, and Disney actually was vigorously courting them because I think the people that they were getting to come in to audition for them, and especially in New York, were strictly song and dance, and which is great for Disney, but Disney was also trying to branch out into the improv,
mm-hmm.
and they were doing a lot more of that at Epcot, at Pleasure Island, at the Disney MGM Studios. There was a lot of immersive improv that was going on the streets there with a thing called Streetmosphere, where they had, it's a themed park themed along 1950s Hollywood, and they peopled the streets with 1950s characters.
Oh, yay.
You know, which was all, how do you interact with people, you know, in an improv situation, be able to set it up so that you've got a story to tell. And they were finding that they, when they would put the improv notices up for auditions in New York City, they were getting, no one was coming in. They were getting a lot of song and dance people that didn't have a lot of improv background. And so they decided they were going to go equity, and they wanted to court equity people specifically and to get a little bit more of a larger group of folks to come to
come from, to call from.
And we set up the first contracts and from whole cloth that Disney and Equity had never had a theme park contract before, so they didn't quite know how to do it. And we figured it out with matrixes, and each show counts this many hours. And so I got a good immersive background in the union while I was working at Disney World, and got my Equity card right off the bat. And
saved a lot of money.
Saved a lot of money.
Amazing.
Moved to New York City with my Equity card, because it's hard to live in New York City as an actor without your Equity card.
Or money.
And I had that, both of those going in there. And then just started auditioning.
And how's it going?
I haven't stopped working since.
Yeah, this is you haven't stopped working since You haven't stopped working since two.
When I first moved to New York, like I said, I had a bit of cash in my back pocket, and fortunately I had 6 months of really good unemployment because I was coming from a full steady time gig coming from Disney World, so I was okay. But I went ahead and got myself a day job. I was working as Kelly. I was a Kelly boy, and I was working for Philip Morris especially. That was the one that because I was one of the only ones, the Kelly boys, who would work in a smoking atmosphere. And it was Philip Morris, so, you know, the smoking giant that was at their headquarters. And I worked there for a year, and I was just putting in ridiculous hours because I was willing to do it. And right. The money was good. I mean, it was New York City money, and 25 bucks an hour is nothing to sneeze at whenever you're still paying off loans and that kind of thing. But I was putting in so many hours. I remember I was doing a show in New York with a director friend of mine, and it was a two-hander. It was a two-person show. And both I and the person that I was in the show with were coming into rehearsals at night after our day jobs, and we were exhausted.
Yeah, I bet.
We were exhausted. She was putting in 60 hours a week, and I was putting in 60 hours a week, and we were just coming in exhausted. And I remember, then this is, you know, this guy was, he was very serious about the show that he was putting together, and we both walked in, and he, after about a half an hour of working with us, he said, "I want you to both go home." He said, "You're both wasted. This rehearsal is wasted. You're not here. You're not focused. You're about to fall asleep. You're not taking in anything. You're making a lot of mistakes." And I went home that night and called Kelly Services, and I said, "Thank you. You've been wonderful. Thank you for giving me all the work that you've been giving me. I can no longer do it." And I never looked back. I've never worked a day job since.
Wow.
That was in 96.
Wow. There are a few actors who can say that.
So I stopped. I stopped my day job. And I remember I was, and it was very, very difficult. It's taking that leap. It's a huge leap, and it's a lot of what it is that I do in my profession is taking tremendous leaps of faith. You take a tremendous leap of faith just going into the profession and making it your primary profession because it's so unorganized. It's so you just don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
I know that I've got a contract through March 9th, and after March 9th, I have no idea what's coming up after that.
Yeah.
And I don't worry about that. I've stopped worrying about it, as a matter of fact. And I stopped worrying about it then. For about a year after giving up that day job, it was a constant struggle of how am I going to pay the rent? Because when that quit and the unemployment ran out, you know, you get into a situation where it's, I have to start taking jobs wherever I can get them, so long as they're acting jobs. And that's when I started working out of town. I couldn't get paid work in New York City. It was just, I didn't know what the secret was. I didn't know what the handshake was. I didn't know what the password was to be seen. And, but there were plenty of theaters out of city that wanted to hire me. And as a result, from about 97 on, I've done very little work in New York City, although I had this great apartment and, you know, with pretty good rent. And, but I never actually worked there. And it's just taking that leap. You take a leap when you get into the profession. You take a leap when you do the work. A part of it is when you work on a character, or when you're performing a character, there's a leap that you take that is not a teachable thing. I don't think it's, or if it is, it's a very difficult thing to teach. And you know it when you see it, when it happens with a student or with an actor, when they go from the place where they are watching themselves, that third eye, constantly judging, you know, where your hand is and where your face is in relation to the audience and all of that silly, you know, facade sort of acting, acting strictly with what's the visual representation, to going to that place where you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what's coming next. Even though you have the lines memorized and you know the arc of the character, you place yourself in a very vicarious state of not allowing you to see what's going to happen next.
Right.
It's insane.
You're living it.
It's crazy. Mm-hmm. I liken it to insanity, in that you are allowing yourself to venture into a place that is unknown. Even though you know what's going to happen, you are able to make a dichotomy between what you know and what you don't know, and you stay on the side of what you don't know.
And what makes me think of, and I don't know whether this is an accurate metaphor, but it's as though you've become untethered.
Right.
You know, you've cut the strings that connect you.
Yes.
Right?
And it's scary. It's frightening, no matter whether you're doing a comedy or a tragedy or whatever it is that you're working on. It's a very frightening place. It's very... It's taking a leap. Mm-hmm. It's taking a leap of faith. You'll find your way through it. You know, you memorize your lines, you rehearse them, you run them over in your head, and then you get to a point where you know them so well that you forget them. You put them away. Well, it's the same thing with the character. I know George in in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf so well that I don't need the words anymore. I don't need any of it. I can walk the streets as George. And think as George. It's the same way, I think it would probably be the same way, I remember a friend of mine, John Kempen, when we were growing up as kids, he and I were best friends, and he was a master of the German language. He learned German in high school and junior high. And then at one point, they brought on a German exchange student into their house. And part of that year, he went to Germany with his German exchange student and lived there for 6 months. And I was asking him at one point, I said, How do you function speaking German? And he said, it was very interesting. He said, the first couple of weeks, I was constantly trying to translate German in my head. Mm-hmm. And he said, there came a point, and I didn't really realize it until after the fact, where I was thinking in German.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that to me is like...
You were thinking in George.
I was thinking in George. I was thinking in the role that I'm playing in Nat in The Birds.
Right.
You know, there... You're no longer you. You are taking on someone else's thought patterns.
But it's like living.
Right. Oh, it is. But you're living another thought pattern.
Right, exactly.
That isn't, it may not have, and a lot of times you'll see people, especially in Hollywood, they'll play themselves a lot.
Yeah.
And it's much easier to do that because you're able to keep all of the ducks in a row. You know what those are because the character you're playing is is mostly you. But when you're playing something that is not you, it's a huge leap, and you're getting to know that character so well that you know how they will react in all situations, even the ones that you haven't rehearsed.
Yes, and so the words come to you because they are what this guy would have said.
They're necessary.
Right. They're necessary to being him.
And what you just said, they're necessary to being him, my natural reaction would be, yes, that's exactly it. That's my natural reaction to what it is that you just said.
Right.
If it were written in the script, we'd go, yes, of course, that's exactly what he would say there. But in real life, that would be my real reaction to what you just said.
Yeah, I got it.
So in the same thing in the script, I have all of all these words. I have all of Connor McPherson's words in the birds. They're in my head, but we throw those away, and we start talking to each other.
And you say what he would have said.
And it just comes out that
way
because that's you're now in the mindset of Nat, not in the mindset of Richard B. Watson. You're in the mindset of George in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and not Richard B. Watson. I'm about to do Nicholas Nickleby in Orlando coming up in November, and that's a six-week rehearsal. That's two plays. It's a six-hour show, basically, but it's split into two parts. It's Nicholas Nickleby Part 1, Nicholas Nickleby Part 2.
When are you doing that?
We go into rehearsal on the 9th of December.
And then when do you run?
6 weeks later, mid-January.
It's a lot of words, right?
A lot. Well, it's two plays.
Yeah.
It's 6 hours.
So, how does it run? I mean, is it one after another or?
Yeah, well, what they'll do is that it's all, of course, all the same cast. And it's two full-length plays, just in chronological order. And both of the plays have a different director. It's team-directed.
So it's the same cast, but different-directed.
Right. But both the directors are on the same page. They're working from the same script. As a matter of fact, I haven't even talked to them how they're going to arrange it, but I don't even know if they're going to actually direct the show separately. They may just literally split scenes up all the way through, or they may split characters up so that one director will deal with a full character's arc amongst the two plays so that there's I have no idea how they're going to deal with it, but that's kind of how you're going to have to do it. And then once we're up in performance, we'll open one show, and then that will have an official preview and open, and then we won't do that show for 3 or 4 days. We'll preview the other show and then open the other show, and then we'll go into rep for the entire week. There'll be 7 performances a week, and then we'll do show 1 on Tuesday night, show 2 on Wednesday matinee, show 1 Wednesday night, show 2 Thursday, show 1 Friday, that kind of thing. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, my God.
But it's easier because it's all the same character.
I understand, but still.
When you're in rep, when you're in true rep, like the Oslo.
Oh, I know.
You're having to deal with 4 different characters and 4 different plays during the week.
The week, you know? I know. I've interviewed some of those people, and they're doing one show on Friday night, one Saturday and matinee, one Saturday night,
right.
Another one Friday. You know, I did
2 seasons over there.
You did?
My first season was when Howard was there, and it was Peter Pan and Sherlock Holmes in the West End Horror. I played Sherlock Holmes in that.
When was this?
6 years ago, 5 years ago.
I didn't see it. Oh, I'm sorry I missed them, but you'll be back, right?
Yeah, hopefully.
Okay, so do you want to talk about Treasure Island?
Sure. What can I tell you?
It's Corinne Aquilina,
Carla Vitale.
Yeah.
And Brett Smock.
Right.
They're the creative team.
Of the musical version of the story Treasure Island.
Right. It's called, the title is Treasure Island, A New Musical.
Aha. Okay. So, just something about it. Where did you do it? What's it like? I mean, are they going to do it again?
Oh, I have no idea. I have no idea. I'm sure they
Who
want
are you?
To. I played Long John Silver.
Ah. Uh-huh.
And I auditioned in New York for the creative team. Evidently, they were having trouble finding a Long John Silver. The show had been completely cast. And the original person that they had to play Long John Silver through all of the readings that they had prior to the first premiere performance couldn't do it. He was unable. He was booked.
Uh-huh.
Something was work. I don't know what the deal was. But they were having a very difficult time finding a Long John Silver. And I went in and prepped as much as I could. You know, I hired a pianist to play all the music for me, so I was very used to the music and knew what it was. And I'd read the play and read the book several times, and avoided seeing the movies, of course. And then went in and I think I knocked it out of the park as soon as I walked in there. And then they called me back, you know, to make sure that it wasn't a fluke, and knocked it out of the park again. And they all kind of came around the table and shook my hands, and they were like, you'll be hearing from us. And sure enough, Bob Klein, the casting director, he called me 2 days later, and he said, I didn't want to say anything to you then, but they had cast you right then and there. Mm-hmm. And so I only had a month and a half to prepare, and we flew down to Little Rock, Arkansas Repertory Theater, and met Bob Huff, the producing artistic director there. He was very gracious. Everybody there was just a marvelous team. The whole team was just phenomenal, and the costumes and lights and sound and the stage design, just everything about that place was just marvelous. And we worked on it for 3 weeks, and you know, this was during the process. They were constantly trying new things because there was a very short amount of 3 weeks for a new musical. It was a very short amount of time.
Yeah, and this is I'm imagining that with the set and all, it was not so simple.
No. It was, well, it's a one-piece set, so there wasn't a lot of flying in and flying out of pieces of scenery, and there was not turntables or anything moving around. So that was a plus. But the downside is the entire set was nothing but stairs. The whole thing. Just platform here, platform here. It was all the way to stairs everywhere, and I was on a peg leg.
Oh, dear.
And so they flew me in early. They flew me in 4 days early to go and meet the prosthetics maker. It was just wonderful. Evidently, Little Rock is one of the places in the United States where the United States military sends all of the veterans or people returning from war who have had
amputation
to get prosthesis. And there's prosthesis people that work specifically for the federal government to help the veterans. And this one guy, this one group, they were so hot on doing the prosthesis for Long John Silver. And we flew in early, and he made this cast of my leg bent. And
oh, my God, you had to have your leg bent the whole time?
Oh, I'm standing up now.
Right.
And showing
Are
him.
Are you kidding?
And it was like this the entire show. But it was wonderful. The guy that actually made mine, he was also an amputee. He was an amputee just below the knee.
Wow.
And so he basically gave me exactly what he has, only extended a little bit further. You know, his cast wraps around the thigh, and it bends underneath, and it holds the rest of his leg in place as a bent thing there, and then the thing comes down right
out. So nobody could see, your leg is sticking out in the back.
It's sticking out, but what we did was he was, Long John Silver had a long skirt on, and not only that, but I asked the costume designer, because I was just so concerned about the, you know, kind of billowing
sticking out.
Well, it's not sticking out, but it was kind of pushing everything back.
Yeah.
That he always had either a staff or a cutlass in his scabbard, which pushed everything out normally.
Ah, so you think it was that.
Right, so every time I touched it, you would see this thing move in the back, either the cane or the scabbard. There was only a couple of times when I pulled it out, and I would always keep my, away from the audience.
So you're literally on 1 foot.
On a stage that is nothing but steps.
Talk about a leap.
And the guy was great, you know, the guy that made the prosthetic, he would bring that once the prosthetic was done after about 7 days of working on it, and that first week of rehearsal, he brought it to the theater, he showed me how to put it on, he showed the stage managers the correct way that it needs to be put on with help quickly, because I had to get in and out of it in between scenes just to relax.
Yes, I'll bet.
And then they cleared the set, one rehearsal of all of the construction people. They sent everybody to lunch for an hour, and it was just him and I on the set walking up. He was like, he showed me how to fall.
Wow.
He said, you're going to fall. Get used to it. I need to show you how to fall, that when you start feeling yourself go, you know how to bend yourself so that you'll fall with the least amount of fall edge.
Right.
Least amount of damage. And he had me fall up the steps. He had me fall down the steps.
Oh,
he had
my God.
The whole nine yards, and got used to it. And as a result, never had a fall.
Yes!
For the entire run of the show.
How long was the run?
4 weeks.
Wow.
And it sold like gangbusters.
Well, then you'd think they could get another production.
There's a lot of competition.
Yeah, well.
You know, and everybody's got their version of Treasure Island. And it was like pulling teeth to get anybody from New York City down to Little Rock. They tried everything. Regional theater, right. You know, of note,
right.
In the country. All of these people, they have the very limited time, and to fly to Little Rock see a show of another version of Treasure Island, it's like, eh. But this was extraordinary. I mean, this was extraordinary production.
Okay, so the only other question I ask, having given a life to this work, and you have given your entire life to this work, is there anything that you would say about it, about what it's like?
It is heaven. When you're doing it. It's ambrosia. It's the nectar of the gods. It's my religion. It's my house of worship. I treat it with a level of respect that one would treat going into their synagogue, going into their church, going into their temple. When I go to see it, it's like going to church on Sunday. I dress up, put on a tie, put on a suit. First meet and greets at any theater, it's always suit and tie. In a way, it's a completely frivolous thing. Most people would say we don't need it. But they would say that only because they've got it. I think it's something that if it were missing, if it were gone, people would notice and they would alleviate that quickly. I think a lot of people look at it as kind of a pointless, frivolous thing, but I would imagine that they would think differently if it disappeared. Mm-hmm. They would notice. And for me, it fills me with about as much happiness as I feel I can contain when I do it. And that's every part of it, from auditions to the frustration of not getting it, not getting the job, the frustrations of sitting by the telephone and waiting for the telephone to ring, you know, or auditioning 100 times and getting not even a call back. To the rehearsal process, which is a religious experience for me. The rehearsal process for me is I kind of joke about it whenever I go into rehearsal or when I show up for rehearsal in the morning, but most of the time when I walk into rehearsal, it occurs to me as you're walking in the door, there is no place that I would rather be than right here, right now, doing what it is that I'm doing. And I'll usually say that. And when I say that, everybody in the room, whether no matter what state they're in, they've just come back from blah, 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 or they haven't had their coffee, or they didn't sleep well that night, they get this look on their face and they go, oh yeah, you're absolutely right. There is no place that I would want to be than right here, right now, doing what it is that I'm doing. It's hard to describe other than to say it's just a religious experience. It's creativity at its essence. It's happening. It's raw. It's organized, but it's raw. And you open yourself up every single time you walk in, and I think that's a great way to exist. It's a great way to live. Jumping off the cliff all the time, every day. First time's the scariest. And after that, it just becomes exhilaration. And who cares if you don't, if there's nothing there to catch you?
That's a great place to stop. Thank you so much,
Thank
Richard
you,
P. Watson.
Who cares if there's no one there to catch you? Is this a declaration of, I am doing what I must do, I am being who I must be, and I am willing to take the risks, to take the leaps, to have it, because it's heaven, because I wouldn't want to be anywhere else than where I am. So, of course, as I say, always when I interview somebody like Richard, that this is what it is like when you are who you really are. And this is what I hope for everyone. This is why I interview people like Richard, so that you can hear that it is possible to be alive in the moment of your life, not to be wondering if this is what you should have done, if you should have done something else, not to be regretting, but to be completely present in the moments of your life because it is who you really are. And so I hope, as always, that you were inspired to ask yourself, is there something in me that I have been cheated out of, that I don't have access to? Is there a passion, a joy, an ability, a talent, an interest, a curiosity that I might be able to recover? And if there is, simply think about it, daydream about it, ask yourself about it. And if you want to do more than that, consider getting some help recovering it. And if you want to talk to me about it, of course, you can find me at my website, thelinshow.com. And so, as always, I hope you got something that you can use from this show, something that amused you, something you didn't know. There was a lot in this show I didn't know. Something that'll bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be, too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. That I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go. From the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle